The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, this is Aaron Ross, co-author of From Impossible to Inevitable, How SaaS and Other Hypergrowth Companies Create Predictable Revenue. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas in order to succeed in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I'll try to point you in the right direction. This show is produced by my marketing firm. We work with manufacturers to help them grow. If you're a manufacturer and are serious about growing your business, check out our guide to lead generation for manufacturers on our website, salesartillery.com, or Google lead generation for manufacturers, and you'll find the guide at the top of the organic results. And special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Blinkist. Blinkist is a really cool app that takes the key insights from the best nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes on your smartphone. Several of the books featured on the Marketing Book Podcast are on Blinkist. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Marketing Book Podcast listeners where you can sign up for free at Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. And if you opt for the paid version, you'll get an additional 20% off, but only if you go to Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast or just click on the link at marketingbookpodcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome back Aaron Ross to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the second edition of the book that he has co-authored with Jason Lemkin, From Impossible to Inevitable, How SaaS and Other Hypergrowth Companies Create Predictable Revenue, published by Wiley. Aaron Ross is a keynote speaker and is the best-selling co-author with Mary Lou Tyler of Predictable Revenue, called The Sales Bible of Silicon Valley, based on an outbound prospecting system that's created more than $1 billion across Salesforce.com and many other companies. He is the co-CEO of PredictableRevenue.com. And, interesting fact, Aaron is married with 10 children, half through adoption, loves motorcycles, and keeps a 25-hour work week. Aaron, congratulations on the second edition of From Impossible to Inevitable, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks, Doug. I'm happy to be here. And I think you mentioned that was the first time you've done a redo.
Yes. Here. This, after 235-something interviews, this is the very first interview with an author about a book that has been on before, but this must have been 3 or 4 years ago. This is the second edition, and in full disclosure to the listeners, it is one of my favorite books. I have written about it. I have given talks that include this. Aaron can't get me to shut up about his book, and there's certain things in the book that I use
because I've tried so hard to get you to shut up about it.
Right. Yes, and here we are again. But seriously, it is one of my favorite books. I borrow from it liberally. I've talked about this. I've talked about your other book. And just a fun fact, there are two friends of mine who live in the north of England, Rob and Kennedy, and they have a podcast called Three Marketers Walk Into a Podcast. And I was recently interviewed on it, and we were chatting and exchanging podcasting tips and one thing or another. It was a lot of fun talking to them. And I said, gosh, you know, there's hundreds of authors I've had on the Marketing Book Podcast. Is there anybody that I might be able to try to help introduce you to who could possibly be a guest. And without hesitation, they both said one name, Aaron Ross. No, none others. They said Aaron Ross.
Isn't that two names, Aaron Ross?
Well, first and last name. But I appreciate your attention to detail, Mr. Ross. Okay. But, I mean, they were interested in many others, but they said we've based our whole – they have a SaaS company, and they based their whole business on your books. And I introduced them to you, and you said, oh, that's perfect. I'm moving to Scotland about 2 hours from them soon. I want to meet more people from there.
Yeah, Edinburgh this year.
That's great. So if you're for all the listeners in that area, please reach out to Aaron. He needs a big welcome there, a big marketing book podcast welcome.
We could use some more friends there.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you'll make many. Plus, with all the kids, you know, I met more people through my kids than I ever did as a grown up. So, but I didn't have 10 kids. So, you know, props to you, Mr. Ross. And yes, to the listener, towards the end of the book, he actually explains how he manages a shorter number of hours working and 10 kids. And it's just fascinating. So now I also have to say one other thing that longtime listeners to the Marketing Book Podcast will have been following. And that is that you have a degree from Stanford, and I've had more authors on the Marketing Podcast with degrees from Stanford than any other school. So clearly, there is some sort of agreement you must sign on your application that you will write a marketing or sales book. And it was nice of you to throw a bone to your co-author who graduated from Harvard. You know, they need all the help they can get.
Try to bring them up on the ranks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they're way back there. But seriously, I think there's been, by this time, at least 20 authors who have spent time there. And of course, there's a lot of authors from Northern California. So before we get into it, I just wanted to read one excerpt and then talk about some of the big ingredients of hypergrowth and then get into these questions. I almost didn't need to read the book because there's so much of it that got me fired up reading it a second time and things that I talk about a lot. But there's a lot of new information as well. So there's never been an easier time to grow a business. Ironically, though, while everyone else around you seems to be crushing their goals, does it feel like a struggle for you? If you needed to triple your revenue in the next year or three, would you know exactly how you would do it? Tripling isn't magic. It's not about the school you went to, luck, or working harder. There's a template that the world's fastest growing companies follow to achieve and sustain hypergrowth. Whether you want to add 1 million or 100 million, the fundamentals are the same. You can grow your business 2 to 10 times faster in honorable ways that feel good to you, your employees, and your customers. In fact, the truth is the best form of sales and marketing. This book shows you how to break growth plateaus and get off the up and down revenue roller coaster, showing you how to answer three questions. One, why aren't you growing faster? Two, what does it take to get to hypergrowth? And three, how do you sustain it? So in the book, you talk about the 7 ingredients of hypergrowth, and we won't have time to get into all of them, but I'd like to just quickly list what they are, and then we'll come back to a few of them that are particularly relevant to the marketing and sales folks. One is to nail a niche, and two is to create predictable pipeline. Three is to make sales scalable. Then double your deal size. Do the time. It's always going to take longer than you think. Embrace employee ownership, which isn't necessarily always financial. It could be functional. And define your destiny. So, Aaron, you write that lead generation is the number one lever that drives revenue growth. But if you can't predictably go out and generate leads and opportunities where you are needed, win them, and do it profitably, you're going to struggle. And spoiler alert for the listeners, there are no shortcuts to doing that. I wish I could tell you there are. But Aaron, what are some of the clues that a company is actually not ready to grow?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Let's talk about that, because I think you mentioned three questions. You know, the first one this book helps you answer is, you know, why aren't you growing as fast as you want? Because the most common problem for companies in trying to grow faster are that they're not ready to grow. Right? They don't have whether it's systems, the infrastructure, the model. There are many reasons why they're not ready to grow. And so if you're not ready and you're spending money on marketing or sales to grow and it's not working, you know, maybe you're just not ready.
And I've dealt with clients like that, and that's why it was so painful reading this the first time a few years ago.
Yeah.
And since then, we've gone back and said to clients, look, we're in the nets business, but first let's talk about your seeds and spears, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
So there's a reason. The first part of the book, as you mentioned, it's called Nail a Niche. Nail a Niche. Because if you haven't done that, you're just not going to be ready to grow. And I'm going to refine, you know, there's all these terms out there like product market fit and who knows what else, but I'm going to be a little more specific in what it takes to be ready to grow.
Great.
So most companies start off and use word of mouth relationships or referrals to get to several hundred thousand, several million dollars, maybe up to 10 million. And then they tend to, at some point, they want to grow faster by spending money on marketing and sales. If it doesn't work, the problem is they haven't figured out how to market themselves to people who don't know them. It's called cold marketing or cold prospecting, outbound marketing, outbound prospecting, because there's an enormous difference. This is what people misunderstand. The difference between someone who comes in as a referral or who's heard of you and the amount of attention they're willing to give you versus someone who's never heard of you and the amount of attention they're willing to give you is like the Grand Canyon. So again, you should use relationships and like whether you're friends, family, network, investors, friends to get those first customers. But at some point, that dependence on relationships for leads and revenue becomes, it's an accelerator at the beginning, and then it becomes a crutch, which stops you from doing the work you need to do to learn how to be able to market and sell yourself without needing those relationships anymore.
Right, and that actually might only be 15% of your potential growth, right?
Well, there's this great book from decades ago called Crossing the Chasm.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Moore.
Yeah, Jeff Moore. It's definitely worth a read. They sort of broken these four different types of buyers out there. Right? There's, I don't remember the exact terms, but sort of like the early adopters. There's the people who, so let me step back. We simplified that. I mean, when I look at this, you want to keep things simple. Really, there's like these psychological principles of why, what this kind of idea of nailing a niche means and how, what's the difference between selling to people who know you where there's some prior relationship versus people where there's not. So we divide it into two categories, early adopters and mainstream buyers.
Mm-hmm.
So early adopters are the types of people that they see your product or service or you, and they just get it. You don't have to explain it or very little. They just get it. Again, whether you have a services company, a product company, and they don't need a huge amount of justification to spend the money. They probably have some of the internal buying influence and power they need to do that. And so they're the ones who are coming in and those early customers who are like, yeah, I get it. Let's do it. And willing to take a chance on you. So Jason Lemkin and I, founder of Saster, who we did the book together, you know, we just estimate, okay, it might be 15% of the market. It's probably lower than that, but it's a minority. And then as you're growing, right, so you get to a few million and past that, and you want to reach out to more people who, again, they're not all the people who aren't calling you. And so if you're doing an outbound marketing, outbound prospecting, and you're reaching out to people who not only they don't know you, so they're willing to give you a tiny bit of attention, whether it's a cold email or a Facebook ad or whatever the way you're sort of touching them, they're only going to give you a tiny bit of attention to kind of see whether or not they're interested. A few seconds, half a second, 10 seconds. But then even if you start that conversation, they're the types that are, they're not going to get it right away. Like those early adopters, the mainstream buyers are going to have to need more explanation and justification. And these are the ones where if you feel like you have to explain yourself five times over and over again, and you're repeating the same thing and you have unending, we need an ROI, this, we need to have a project plan, we need to have this, that, because they need to have all those details filled out because they don't intuitively get it.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're also, they might be, or they're selling to more people or bringing more people in. And for those kinds of buyers, again, this shift of how, in order to grow, you need to know how to ultimately becoming relationship independent is to be able to intrigue people And so intrigue people and interest them in conversations, even if without having to have a relationship ahead of time. So your messaging has to be very focused and tight and be results-based. You have to have a product or service that can really stand on its own, right? To go through those kinds of justification process with the ROI and the case study and the project plan, all the details and the technical review and all that. And with these mainstream buyers, they're going to be much more risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the product or service has to be able to stand on its own. It has to be able to, the value of what you're delivering has to be apparent to the buyer. And I'll give you an example. Most services companies, and right, I have a services company, predictablerevenue.com. And a lot of my customers, we have about 30 or 40 people. It's a several million dollar business around outbound prospecting and expertise and so on. A lot of our customers come in because they've read my books. They know me, and whether I talk to them or not. And so that brand, that relationship has been incredibly helpful to get the company to several million dollars. But now it can become a crutch, because to get past that, you know, we have to redesign our products and services to be so obviously valuable to buyers that whether my name is on the company or not, or predictable revenues on the company or not, they would still want to buy them. Hmm. And that's where most companies get stuck. They're so used to selling to people who know them because, again, word of mouth, referrals, relationships, or customers are sending their way, or there's this brand benefit. And they start to try to market and sell themselves to people who don't know them, and they get stuck and they're not sure why. Like, why aren't people getting this?
Yeah. So related to that, explain the difference, and it's a painful difference, between nice to have and a need to have.
Yeah, that's great, because that's probably the simplest way to start to boil this down to what do I do with this? So most businesses are trying to sell themselves to too many types of customers in too many ways. So if you step back, and you look at, hey, most of your top 10 or 20% of your customers, we do want to focus on the ones where there's been the most revenue. And you want to look at the ones, pick out, hey, which ones have been the easiest to close, sign, for the most money, and that where you had the best results with them. Let's look at those ideal customers. Now, how is that group different from either the customers that didn't buy with you or the customers that bought but didn't work? And what we're really looking to do is say, yes, your product or service could be used by so many types of customers. It could be. But if they don't need you, right? If it's when it's a nice to have versus a need to have, if they don't need you, they're not going to buy, or it's not going to work. If it's a nice to have to them, it just takes a lot of time and energy to evaluate, purchase, and implement something.
So a need to have would be a hole in your roof that is leaking. A nice to have is painting the room.
Yes.
In the home.
Yep. You know, with a car, right? If you have a flat tire, you have to fix that. I can't drive it, but I have to fix it. Getting the door locks fixed or getting the oil temperature checked because there's a light on is a nice to have. My oil temperature light is on, but my car is working. I don't have to fix it now.
Not right away.
No, but you will see, I guarantee you will see these differences between when you say, hey, here's the nice to haves, companies who didn't buy, especially, and maybe it didn't work. Versus the ones where they bought and it worked well. And how do you discern the differences? And again, it could be anything around size of company, people they had on board, what was going on, was there some sort of trigger event? Is there different funds? Is there different geographies? You're just looking for anything that could help you discern the differences between those two groups, because then you can be much more insightful about not only focusing on targeting the right kinds of companies and identifying when they need you and why they need you. So not only you can be so much more focused on them because you know how to find them, how to spot them. And it's a lot easier to message companies, a more specific group of companies, because your messaging can be much more targeted to them rather than when you're trying to write messaging that can appeal to anybody. You know, a simple example could be financial services companies, right? That's such a huge, if you say, hey, we target financial services companies. Okay, great. It's so broad versus if you say, hey, you know, we target mid-market insurance companies that focus on whose primary line of business is auto insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's these fears that come up frequently, which is, oh, well, we don't want to be too small. Our market could be so big. Like so many other people, everyone could use us. But when you try to serve everybody, you become so vague and generalized that people can't hear your message. It's like a radio station saying, well, everybody likes this music. Like, why don't we'll play rock and jazz and blues and classical, right? So whatever they want, we could do that,
mm-hmm.
right? But versus radio stations that say, you know, we're K-Rock and we're the rock station, Right? People can tune in to that very clear signal of like, this is what we stand for. This is our type of customer. And that makes it easier for them to say, oh, yes, we're interested in you, and to see how you stand out from the noise.
They're also able to articulate, these are not who we're trying to appeal to.
Yeah. Here's when it's not a fit.
Right, right. So
we'll waste our time.
One of the most important things is having deeper insights into your customers and your competition. Just that alone, I've seen so many companies win because of it. And whereas a lot of companies will focus more on their competition or their own operations, and you talk about the importance of walking in your customer's shoes, but you write that you should not confuse meeting with customers and listening to them. And you say the more customers you listen to, not just pitch or sell to, the more you'll be able to think like your customers, and most importantly, to empathize with them. So please explain the 20 interview rule. I talk about it all the time, but I need someone like Aaron Ross to say, look, I'm not the only one banging the table about the 20 interview rule.
Yeah, no, this is a great one from actually co-author Jason Lemkin. But so there's a section here, which ultimately, again, sort of this idea of nailing a niche. And again, if you're in Europe or Canada, niche, nailing a niche is really, this is the starting point. Because if you don't do this, the money you spend on part two, which is lead generation, isn't going to work. And the money you spend on part three, which is making sales scalable, isn't going to work. So in this case, a lot of what's missing in terms of executive teams and salespeople and companies is this empathy of the customer. It's the, I know what it's like to be in my customer's shoes, which means I can write to them, I can speak to them, or I can create content to them in a way that they get it. Because most of the content that gets created, whether it's in sales emails, in blog posts, really is just it's not really written for customers. A lot of marketing material is written, it's like boilerplate marketing material.
Or it's written for the CEO or the product engineers, yes. People who love their own product.
Yes, it's written for the board. It's written for the investors. It's written for the executive team. Right? We're getting feedback from the executives. Hey, executives, what do you think? Don't do that. Don't get feedback from your friends, and don't get feedback from people internally, because they're not your customer. So we end up with this marketing language that's very wordy and very jargony, because mm-hmm. We want to sound fancy. We want to sound smart, or that's just what we learned. And what we don't have is really simple, direct, blunt language that appeals to the customer. So how do we get that? In general, interviews so we'll get to the 20 interview rule, but interviews is one way to do that. Sales calls, more conversations when you're really listening. So the 20 interview rule came about when you're really starting for something like a company from scratch, or it's really new. It's a new product. It's new messaging. And so the first five interviews are, getting your kind of like product and understanding right. And the next five interviews is around getting your pitch down. And the next five is around like validation. I actually don't remember exactly how we broke it out, but the idea is people don't do enough interviews just to learn. There's a difference between doing an interview because you're trying to like pitch something, you're trying to get someone, right. You have an agenda. When you have an agenda besides learning, it's different versus you're just listening. And what you're listening for, here's an example, what you're listening for really in interviews, whether you have a product or not, if you're just doing, let's assume most companies here, you have a product and you're doing interviews around how to understand how to write the messaging differently. Mm-hmm. That really resonates with your customers in a deeper way, in a more obvious way. In that case, what you're looking for is you're really looking for how does your customer think? What are the thoughts? What are the thoughts in their head that they already are thinking about that you don't need to translate for them? So if I'm selling to a VP of marketing, right, and that what they're saying, what are you working on? What's bothering you? What are you doing these days? And you're looking for the lingo. Which is, I got this metric, my lead conversion rate's too low because I'm trying to get my SQLs up and my pipeline is down, or my social this, that, the other. And you're actually looking for those nuggets, like the words, like the key phrase. It's almost like a SEO search. What are the words, keywords, and key phrases they're saying or writing, right? Because that's that, if I took those keywords, key phrases, and if I put them back into cold email or, my blog post, but you're trying to pull them out of their brain, because let's go back to when you are marketing and selling to people who don't know you already, and the amount of mental energy that they're willing to invest in figuring you out is very low. You want to reduce the translation of your material to their brains to zero if possible. So if you say, so I have a customer now who does an AI, enterprise AI. We provide enterprise AI. We provide AI for your enterprise to solve problems. And you're like, okay, but what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, what I'm not hearing is anything related to that prospect's problems or pain, specifically such that the prospect might say, dang, it's like these guys have been listening in on my calls. It's like they really understand me and my problems. And let me just add, because I just had the pleasure of reading this, in the 20 interview rule, as I understand it, you have learn from the first 5 and confirm in the next 5, in the last 10, or to filter out the nice-to-haves from the must-haves.
There you go. You know better than I do right now.
Well,
that's true, because there's so many ideas. Like, to me, if there's this Uber trend of information overwhelm, too much content, channels, apps, everything. And the future skill, this nailing a niche practice, this skill is, I would say, the number one counter trend to overwhelm, which is really about focusing and simplification. And it's hard when you can do, so many opportunities. How do you really refocus and simplify the things that matter most with the way in general, but also the value, the type of customer that you want to target and the value that you can bring to them.
Right. And you also talk about how niche, it's not about going small. It's about being more specific and aligning with the pains and problems of your customers. So don't misunderstand that niche does not mean small. It means more specific. And actually, as I like to say, there are riches in niches. Of course, I didn't come up with that. But also, pigeonholes are stuffed with cash.
I haven't heard that one.
You've never heard that one?
No.
I think I stole that from Brian Clark or Blair Enns or someone smart like that. But I just wanted to drop one little value bomb. You talk about elevator pitches, okay, or whatever, we all hear these terms, whatever you want to call them. You recommend that whether you have a fancy pitch ready or not, the next time someone at a party asks you what you do, pretend instead that they asked, how do you help people? So when they say, who do you work for? What do? Instead, answer the question, how do you help people? Now, I want to go on to another section, and I have to preach. I have to read from this, and it's the beginning of part 2, and it's about—
Preach on, brother.
Yeah. Can I get an amen?
They call this the growth Bible now.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I wrote in my book, as I often do, I wrote, carve this in stone, and I wrote an arrow towards it. The painful truth, overnight success is a fairy tale. You're not going to be discovered with a viral video, post, or product that makes all your lead generation that'll make all your lead generation problems magically disappear. And then you go on to talk about how lead generation absolves many sins.
Oh, I forgot about that Bible, the sins thing. That's a good—
Yeah.
That was by accident, actually.
Preach, brother. Yeah. Mm. And in fact, I think that was one of the blog posts I wrote a few years back about absolving sins. So you say you can have the best product, investors, or sales process, but without predictable ways to fill your revenue or sales pipeline, you're going to struggle. Predictable lead generation is the lever to create hyper growth, and it's more than throwing marketing campaigns online or on billboards, cold calling, or pumping out free stuff to give away. Aaron Ross, there are 3 types of lead generations, a 3-legged stool, if you want. Mm-hmm. Seeds, nets, and spears. What are they? And why do too many companies obsess over a single form of lead generation and ignore the others?
Great question. Right? So this is something I discovered years ago in seeing why companies struggled to grow, especially companies that were growing. So the example in the book other times is for a company we did $3 million last year, or it could be 30, doesn't really matter. We'd had 3,000 leads. So next year, we're going to, let's double. Let's get to 6 million in revenue. So we need 6,000 leads. We need twice as many, right? Wrong. So wrong. Because a lead is not a lead is not a lead. Again, early days, most companies have. So the seeds, nets, and spears really is helping people understand that there's word of mouth leads that are completely very different. Those are the seeds. Then marketing leads, right? These are the nets, right? The kind of one to many. Mm-hmm. And those are very different than the spears, which would be outbound prospecting or outbound business development leads. So they all have their pros and cons. And I think people get into trouble when they don't understand what's worked for them and what doesn't work. So let's go back to usually companies start off with building, getting to several million through relationships.
Right. Like you talked about earlier, the seeds.
Yep. The seeds. And the great thing about relationships or seeds is that they're the best kinds of leads.
Yes.
Right? Faster to close. I hope that's obvious. But the problem with them is they're hard to grow. They are hard to grow. You can't just spend money and grow your relationship-based leads. What you can do, we do recommend the best way to create more predictable seeds, right? A predictable way to create more relationship-based leads is by investing in a customer success program. So really that means, and this is a standard in Silicon Valley, in hypergrowth companies, which is a person or team dedicated just making sure that your customers are successful, that they get value from the product or service they do, that they understand that value, and have more documentation around testimonials or case studies or references.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will create more referrals and also have customers stay longer and be happier.
Right. And Aaron, you say that if you're a CEO, you need to take customer success as seriously as marketing, sales, or product development. Maybe you should explain the difference between customer success and customer support.
Yeah, let's do that. Well, customer success really started, I know it started at Salesforce. I don't know if it was before that, but that's where at least I ran into it because we had a customer success team in the early days. You know, so I worked at Salesforce from 2002 to 2006. And, you know, it's one of these models where in the enterprise software days before, software company, customer writes a big check, and then whether the project goes well or not, you got your money, and you know, it's kind of the customer is where they are. In the SaaS model, subscription model, you know, it changed that, which is if your customer is not happy, they, you know, can leave much more easily, right? And you don't get all your money up front. So there's a lot more incentive for the business models. And this is why a lot of business models depend on customers who are successful, who are happy. Mm-hmm. Or satisfied in some way.
The marketing world can learn a lot from the SaaS world about customer retention and subscription marketing, if you will.
Yeah. And this doesn't have to be just for SaaS companies. It's just that's where the business model makes is kind of made it mandatory. So
yes.
People had to do this. But customer success, in my mind, really means that even from product design and target market selection is picking the right customers up front and servicing them so that they are happy, they get value from the company, from your service, and you're avoiding customers that are not going to be a good fit. So in other words, customer success is preventing, a lot of ways it's preventing fires from being started in the first place.
It's fire prevention.
Fire prevention, while customer support is fighting fires.
Yes, oh,
there's
great.
Two sides of the same coin. Sometimes they can be combined, but really it's about you know, being more proactive and really focusing on the right customers for the right reasons and giving them more attention and help to get off the ground and get value from whatever you do for them.
Mm-hmm.
And realizing, I would even say realizing again today with this, I mentioned this Uber trend of overwhelm, customers, I think more often than not, are depending on vendors to tell them what to do.
Yes.
These mainstream buyers who don't have that sort of early adopter or leader, and they need more handholding. Maybe they always needed it, but maybe it's just more obvious that customers need more handholding. They want more direction from you. They want to be told how to make this successful. So customer success also can translate to education and teaching and best practices of your customers and how to run their business better in those areas that you affect.
Right. So seeds, nets, and spears. Now, just so you know, the point you just made about fire prevention versus firefighting, I just added it to the bottom of a long list. On the top of the list, it's more stuff to steal from Aaron Ross, with full attribution, of course. But chapter 6, for me, alone is worth the price of the book for any marketer. Now, you were nice enough to send me a copy of the book, but it's about nets and it's about marketing. And I'm sorry, this is the third time I've got to quote from the from the Gospel of Aaron. Okay, out of a trillion ways to market. Okay, now let me back up. Nets. We're talking about marketing generated leads here.
Yeah. So we've
talked about seeds,
like billboards, online marketing.
Right. Right. So we're out of a trillion ways to market. Inbound marketing or content marketing is the most popular kid in school. It works, and it works for every company. Unlike, say, outbound prospecting, the idea is creating marketing that customers love or learn from, inspiring them to want more from you, eventually buying your stuff. But inbound marketing has matured enough that we can't see the dark side. Inbound lead dependency and reactive cultures. But you say still every business benefits from creating content. Explain this phenomenon going on here, because just like with companies that think, all we need to do is work our relationships, they are the ones that claim they get all their business from referrals. Or companies that say, we only do outbound. Or they look at a company like ours and they say, well, we're going to get all our leads from you guys. It's like, oh, God, I wish that were the case. But So the same thing is going on within the marketing, within the nets. It's like inbound versus outbound. It's this human brain desire for simplicity. But you talk about how outbound is actually going to be growing much more in the next 10 years. What are you trying to help these people understand who are looking for one or the other, but instead it should be like the Reese's cup?
Yeah.
Chocolate and peanut butter.
Yeah. So step back, right? Seeds, nets, and spears. So relationship-based leads, you know, nets are marketing leads, and then spears are the outbound prospecting or the business development, really where there's like a human with a targeted list getting appointments.
Yeah.
All three of those are great, but they each have their pros and cons. And depending on the type of business and stage, you tend to want to focus on sort of one at a time to build it mostly. So if you're early days and you're just trying to get your product off the ground with, you know, customers, you really just need to focus on those, the customer success, right, the seeds. And then at some point you get a little bigger, people tend to focus either on marketing, right, the nets, or outbound prospecting or business development, the spears, kind of depending on the business and your basically what you feel passionate about. Some people are passionate about one or the other. They all have their pros and cons. Right? With marketing, the great thing about marketing is you can sort of reach a lot of people, you can generate lots of leads, hopefully.
Some good, some bad. They're not always all
going to be. Exactly.
It's going to be big fish and little fish.
Yep. And you have content out there that could just sit out there generating, you know, leads over time. The downside is a lot of those leads aren't going to be a fit, and they're generally going to be, your average deal size will be a lot smaller.
Right.
Than perhaps what you want.
And they may be further along on their customer journey, if you will.
Yeah. Yep. Maybe. Sometimes. Yeah, usually.
Than some of the ones that you could reach by outbound prospecting, where you are helping them understand the problems they have that they might not have even been aware of.
Yep. Plus, they're further on their buying journey, and they're also talking to all your competitors.
Yep.
So there's these pros and cons, like level three. On the outbound prospecting side with spears, some of the advantages are we can go out and talk to other people who aren't calling you. You're going to have bigger deal sizes because you will be more selective about the opportunities you pursue. The downside, you have fewer, right? So it's quality over quantity with that prospecting. In marketing, so let's focus on marketing. So again, most companies, you want all three at some point. You don't do it all at the same time. And the content marketing works for everybody, because whether you're a services company, product company, I mean, it always helps to put your message out there about yourself, what you stand for, what you can do, whether it's in blog posts and videos. Blogs don't generally generate leads, but even if people find you somehow, or they meet you at a conference and they can go read about you, learn about you on your site, there's lots of reasons why putting more of yourself out there is beneficial to any company. Prospecting is a bit different. If you're a consultant, if you're in a super crowded market, it just may not, or if you have lots of just really small deals, like a customer's worth a few hundred or a few thousand dollars.
Right.
Outbound prospecting may not work. It can get a little more complicated, but ultimately there's these pros and cons. And with marketing, you know, in this book, it's actually my VP of revenue, Mina Sandhu, wrote this section on three uncommon practices of hypergrowth CMOs. And what she, part of one of these three practices is really helping, I think, marketers try to differentiate this idea of inbound marketing and outbound marketing. Because the term inbound has kind of gotten associated with marketing and completely associated, but really there's inbound marketing, outbound marketing. And this is where I hope it doesn't get confusing with outbound prospecting, but outbound marketing is this idea of how can you use marketing techniques to reach out to new kind of markets and customers that aren't going to be contacting you. So PPC could be one. Mm-hmm. Types of events. Be different than content marketing, social media marketing, which, again, you're tending to try to like put things out there and people find you and come to you. So if she put more detail around those differences, that I think she's trying to help marketers understand that the way, again, sometimes your goals and the way you measure those different kinds of practice can be different so that you can be more insightful about how do you grow leads and how do you grow the right kinds of leads at the right sort of financial margins.
Okay, so outbound efforts, outbound marketing, you say it's largely dismissed, misunderstood, and mislabeled. How so and why?
Yeah, let's talk about over many years, there's the old practices are now not cool, right? In direct mail, cold calling, billboards, kind of classic marketing techniques. Now, of course, not everyone thinks that way, but as a generalization, people want, hey, why don't we just do scalable marketing and like the cool stuff like Instagram or Facebook ads? And so there's, I think, this lack of neutrality, this lack of unbiased viewpoints on here's all these marketing options we have. Which ones really might work best for us? Maybe it is some form of direct mail. Maybe it's not. Maybe because there's so many options. And like there's the hot kids in town, which is like Facebook. It was Google. Now it's Facebook. It's always changing, right? Because
sure.
Facebook, everyone gets into Facebook and then the prices go up and it gets more competitive. It's already over. I hear it's already priced to market. It's already competitive. It's hard to make money at it. So I did a workshop in Belgium a couple weeks ago. And there's a company that had grown to $10 or $15 million in revenue in Europe, really off the backs of Google PPC. So Google PPC paid media with Google as then moved to Facebook. And he said in the last year or two, the cost of leads from Facebook especially had doubled or tripled. And so it got to the point where they're not going to make money. Like the lead gen costs on Facebook became unprofitable. And like, I don't know where I'm going to grow my company now. I need to find a new channel. So these channels always get, eaten up, and it's true everywhere. It's like the success of a channel makes it unsuccessful in a way.
Right. The good marketers are arbitrage experts who are able to get in there quickly. But let me ask you this then. If a company's not quite sure what to do, what to get started, let's say they're at that 15% where they say, we've made growth from that part that's before we cross the chasm. We're ready to move on. What should we do? Would a good mental model for them to be thinking about be, of course, their seeds, but should they then be at least trying to check the box or giving some consideration to nets and spears?
Yeah, well, I think every company is some form of all three if you really want to grow quickly. And you mentioned something important I want to come back to, which is companies that get stuck with one form of lead generation.
Yeah.
So a lot of fast growth tech companies get stuck with this product-led growth. Hey, we're going to create the best product and people are going to love it. And they'll just tell their friends. And that's how we won't need to market. We won't need to prospect.
How does that normally work, Aaron Ross?
We may not even need to sell. Well, it works great for Slack.
Yeah.
And
you know what?
Doesn't work very well.
Someone wins the lottery every week. Yeah. Someone wins the lottery every week, but I don't play the lottery.
Right. There's enough stories where it creates that myth of, oh, if I just create a great product,
yeah,
everyone's going to come in and it's an overnight success. Everyone's going to want them.
Right.
Right, that's not true. So I think, again, we want to be smart and insightful about this, which is different forms of lead generation will get us to different stages. Right, so having a great product or service will get us to a few million, or a few hundred thousand, a few million typically. Having great marketing could get us to several million, several tens of millions, whatever the level is. Adding great outbound prospecting as well could, again, double that, like adding several million, several tens of millions. Or, again, there's companies like Salesforce and others, which hundreds and millions or billions. So it's the of layering on, which is no matter how well this is working for me. I remember talking to a board member of New Relic years ago who said, well, we already have so many, Like, we're growing so fast with referrals and maybe it's marketing that we don't need to do prospecting. I'm like, great, because you don't want more growth. It's not even that. I think at some point, inbound leads plateau.
Yep.
And, or outbound can plateau. It depends on the market. So whatever you put all your eggs in, the basket you put it in, know that if you need to create, the next time you need to create a new channel, it's probably 6 months, you know, 4 to 12 months to create that new channel. So if you are all dependent on outbound and then you want to go inbound, or all dependent on inbound, go outbound, or all dependent on seeds, relationships, and then add something else, you should start like a year in advance if you're starting from scratch.
But you talked in the book about the CEO who says, I want to see growth in 90 days. And then you say, well, what's your normal sales cycle like? A year and a half.
Yeah, or 6 months. Yeah. But that's kind of that impatience feeling, because people wait too long and they think, oh, this will go on forever. Oh, but these inbound leads will just grow forever. And then when they don't and you hit a wall, you're like, oh, I need to fix this right now. I don't have 90 days. I don't have 6 months. I have to fix it in 30 days.
Or, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. I made promises to my board, so on and so on. It's way too long. Things don't happen that fast.
So, Aaron, let me ask you a question that's on the mind of a lot of CEOs, sales, marketing people, and it's about sales and marketing alignment. And at one point in the book, you say, you know, goodbye sales versus marketing, hello revenue team. Mm-hmm. So what should marketing and sales be measuring to get them better aligned, get them to stop this unproductive fighting?
Yep. Well, there's always been this argument between sales and marketing. And there's reasons for that, because they have different kind of values and goals typically and objectives. So I don't, the SDR team and function itself has made a huge difference in helping bridge that gap. So SDRs, whether they're inbound SDRs or outbound.
And that's a sales development rep.
Yeah, sales development rep, sometimes called business development rep. Well, whatever the names are, these are the junior salespeople. And the inbound ones take marketing leads and they respond to them and only pass the right ones to sales.
Right.
The outbound SDRs, the outbound people, do all the cold prospecting. So they're going out to generate appointments for salespeople. And those functions need to be separate.
Yes.
If you're someone who has junior salespeople, whether you call them BDRs, SDRs, ABCs, CIAs, whatever they are, and you have the same people doing both inbound lead response and outbound prospecting, is a big, big no-no. For many reasons, might need a separate episode on.
Okay.
But in terms of the alignment,
we'll cover that on the third edition of the book.
Yeah, that's what you said. Because, you know, look, if you're a marketer, if you're sending leads straight to salespeople, they're not going to follow up on them. Unless it's like one, they're super, you know, sometimes you have like these super hot, like demo leads that they just can't wait for, sure. But other than that, they're not. So you can't blame them, because they're just not. And there's salespeople, you know, most of them, they're going to be busy. It's just not their thing. So rather than blaming them, having an SDR function to respond to inbound leads is the biggest step. But there's two other major things that companies can do. So there's probably three major things. You know, one is there is one single revenue leader, whether you know it or not. So there has to be one. It's more common now for companies to have a chief revenue officer, mm-hmm. or like we do, we have a VP of revenue and she owns sales and marketing. And sales and marketing both report up to whoever this person is, or maybe they own one. Maybe they really are the marketing person, but they also own sales. So that's one step. If you have a CEO and they have a VP of sales and VP of marketing, the CEO is the revenue leader. But here's the difference, is that the revenue leader has to be hands-on enough with those functions to ensure that there's sync and coordination.
Right.
Most C-levels, the revenue leader by default are too hands-off. They let marketing do their thing, sales do the thing. No, you need to be more hands-on. So that's number one. Recognize there is a revenue leader, whether you kind of acknowledge it or not. And number two, marketing needs to be measured on, you know, we suggest sales qualified leads. Mm-hmm. So marketing first has to have some kind of quota or metric. That's more common now.
Well, that's aligned with sales and revenue, I would think.
Yes.
Because they can generate a lot of crappy leads, and that's the complaint of so many salespeople.
Right. And so the metrics on number of leads and cost per lead are better than not have something, but they're also in some ways worse, because they just are so misleading. Mm-hmm. Right? I can generate, this goes back to seeds, nets, and spears. One seed lead, right, which could be a word of mouth, could be worth 100 or 500 marketing leads, like webinar leads. So if I have a goal of reaching 1,000 leads a month, you know, that doesn't, I can get lots of poor leads.
Yeah, I'll raffle off a car.
Yep. So what's a better metric? I mean, we recommend not just a lead commit, but a commit around basically sales qualified leads or sales accepted leads. Mm-hmm. And again, there's so many terms, but the type of lead that is a lead that has gotten passed to a salesperson and the salesperson has requalified it and accepted it into their pipeline.
Right.
And measuring that, because that's what sales cares about. Sales doesn't care about new leads or marketing. Sales doesn't care about marketing qualified leads either. They care about how many leads actually make it to the pipeline. And yes, there's more responsibility for both parties to define what does that mean? What are the qualification criteria? And inbound or outbound opportunities are different. So there's different criteria for those. So you do have to work together more closely. You can't just throw leads over the fence.
Yeah.
So not only do you have a single metric that both sides care about, but you have to work together. You have to work together more closely to make sure that it works and is doable.
Right. So, Aaron, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask one more question, and it's one that I first learned about when I read the first edition of your book a few years ago. And like several things in your book, it seared itself into my subconscious. Thanks, Ross. But it's a good thing, and it changed your life dramatically. And I want you to explain what a forcing function is and how it works with Aaron Ross.
Sure. Let's skip ahead towards further back in the book. So for me, you know, what I learned is that I've got lots of great ideas, probably too many great ideas.
And you got a few things going on, a few kids, a business.
Yeah, I got some kids.
Yeah.
So back and, you know, really, I went from zero to nine kids in 6 years. It was like the biggest kind of growth, like hyper growth of the family.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you're Aaron Ross. You're all about growth. You're all about hyper growth. So you're just living, you know, you're leading by example.
True. It's like hyper family growth, hyper personal growth.
It's your next book.
Yeah. So zero to lots of kids within 6 years. And then I grew my own income from like 70-ish thousand a year when I was single to 11 times that in 4 years, because, you know, I had to, because it's a big family. And I wrote 4 books along the way at that same time, and so on. And our business, we grew a business from, again, small, under 100,000 to now it's about 4 million-ish in that time. So it sounds like a lot, and it is, but the way, and I also really stuck to this work week of 20, 25 hours of most weeks of working. And by the way, it's hard for me to work more than that with such a big family. So the one thing that I think really, if you ask me, hey, there's never one thing, by the way. And anyone who tells you there's one thing is full of shit.
Or one marketing tactic or one closing expression.
It's retarded. They're just trying to sell you something. But there was one of the things that for me made the biggest difference in being able to do this and being able to make more money by a lot and to get things done and have time for my kids. To be a better parent and business person at the same time. And by the way, that whole topic is something I really want to develop over the next, you know, next. It's like, how do you integrate your career and parenting rather than trying to feel like you're balancing one or the other, where one wins, the other loses?
Yeah, or feeling like you're doing one or the other wrong.
Yeah, which, well, I don't know if that ever goes away because with parents. But forcing functions really for me are, you know, the thing with my family and us is there's lots of people who talk about things like adoption, but how many people actually do it? It's so easy to talk about stuff. How do you do it? Especially when you're tired and exhausted all the time. So forcing functions to me is the difference between, all right, you want to get back in shape. So A, do you go sign up for the gym to go work out? Or B, do you sign up to do a marathon and tell all your friends?
Uh-huh.
Right. That especially there's a deadline. There's a fear of public sort of there's public commitment, whether it's public commitment or public fear, public shame. So it's for me a committing to things in ways where I can't back down.
Mm-hmm. Or you'll lose your honor.
Yeah. Whether it's losing honor or whether it's a way to just make sure that I'm focused on something and have to do it.
Right, right.
It's a few things, but I will say, like, for let's take the book From Impossible to Inevitable. The first time it came out, right? Huge, big family. How am I going to, and I have a business, I have a day job. I have to make money. I worked at Salesforce early, but not early enough where I have to make money. And so how I write a book on top of that, but from scratch. And so part of this was even by, I found a partner like Jason Lemkin. We found a publisher and we took steps. We committed to dates. And so then like it had to happen. I had people counting on me for my part of it. Mm-hmm. And there was dates and like a date just creates so much clarity. So yeah. I blocked out Wednesdays to write for what I did. So it forced me to, all right, backwards. And it just kind of forced the prioritization and for me to block out the time and to do it and to not overthink it, not to be perfectionist in things. And just sometimes you just got to get things done to get over either perfectionism, procrastination, resistance, fear of, is this going to be good enough, to get into the flow of it and just like move it forward. So another forcing function is that another one would be, wow, you know, do we want more kids? Okay. Well, we want to adopt one. Let's even like sign the papers. Or if my wife gets pregnant, it's like, we just know that we'll just figure out how to manage things once the baby comes, or how to pay for it once the baby comes.
Right.
It's a different example. It's kind of this, it's a little bit of the leap in the net will appear approach.
Right. Right. And you talk about how, of course, you concluded the book with a bit of Beavis and Butthead humor, which of course just spoke to me on a very deep cycle.
That was
Beavis and Butthead for maybe the younger listeners. That was a MTV show of these two ill-behaved teenage boys who were very immature. And I can remember when it would be on, my wife would say, turn that off. It was right after we'd gotten married, and she was probably thinking, like she still does, what was I thinking when I married this guy? But anyway, you talk about, a lot of people have SMART goals, which a lot of people, you know, marketers have heard about, these specific, measurable, assignable, realistic, and time-related goals. And those are all very, very helpful. They really help companies tie down realistic goals using that SMART acronym. But what you talked about is creating forcing functions made up of simple asses. He said ass. So number one is announce to others that you'll create a blank, a book, a marathon, or whatever. Number two, specific outcome by a whatever, and then by a specific date. So announce a specific outcome by a specific date. And then you go on to say, if you're an overachiever, you could possibly combine the two approaches into smart-ass goals, but that's too much for me. But but Aaron Ross, that was not too much for the very immature host of the Marketing Book Podcast. So Aaron, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
So here's the one thing is that, you know, growing a company, and by the way, these principles actually work for people and careers if you just read it that way. Growing a company, like growth, can be more of a system than people realize. There's more of an engineering approach to it than people realize. It doesn't mean that it's easy, right? It can be simple, but not easy. But there are systems here. And I really, this book really encapsulates so many years and so many billions of dollars of learnings between Jason and myself in terms of what creates growth and what doesn't. And I mean, this is where even my own, you know, growing my income by 11 times and so on, that's a lot of the same principles here. It's the, you know, sort of be a specialist in an area. Mm-hmm. And the way you kind of describe that is important. Create opportunities for yourself, which is, you know, so nail a niche, predictable pipeline, sales, so be a specialist, create opportunities, learn how to kind of sell and close them, and then some other steps. But it's there's a formula, there's a system towards creating more growth. We didn't get to the part around it's going to take longer than you want.
Right. Yeah,
that's another painful truth. The thing, whatever you want, is going to take years longer than you want.
And there'll be a year of hell.
There's going to be a year of hell. Hopefully only one, maybe more than one. But there
that's
will
a
be
good
a year
thing.
Of hell.
That's a good thing.
Yep. It's not a bad thing. Once you get past it, right. And some of these, the worst problems you have can be the thing to power you, your success in the future once you get through them, hopefully, if you have a growth mindset. But that there's a system here, right? It's not random. It's not luck. Anyone can get further on the path towards growing their businesses or their own income farther than they realize. And with, I know, I think people are calling this now the growth Bible. We wanted to put together a system that really, like, this really will change people's lives, this book. Like, I wish I could just take this book and the ideas and, like, stick them in people's heads, because I can't think of how many companies, or people even told me that I wish I'd had this book years ago, would have, you know, changed my company, saved my company, done this, that, and the other. But this are, I've had a company go out of business. I know that how painful it is. Two of the most painful experiences in my life were a company that went out of business and a divorce.
And you were painfully honest in the book about this.
Yeah.
And I should add that the book is really, really inspirational. So the things we talked about, that was we were only scratching the surface.
Yeah, barely. And
I'm sorry, but these listeners, they've already driven to work. They're sitting in the parking lot waiting for this to end so they can go in. So a little empathy here, Mr. Ross. So, but it's so true about the system, and that's why we like working with manufacturers, because there's lots of engineers there, and they get this. They tend to be very, well, not all the engineers, but they tend to understand systems. When you present it in that way, there's usually some very big pickup.
I mean, I was an engineer, so I think that's a lot where this comes from is – even at Salesforce, I wanted to engineer some, I just didn't like all the randomness of felt in sales and, you know,
yes.
Are things going to work or not? And
oh, wow. So did you study engineering as a undergrad?
Civil engineering. Oh. I did computer science in high school.
Oh.
So I've coded, I mean, this is pre-internet, so it's more like MS-DOS, Turbo C, Turbo Pascal, Object C, and whether it's on, if anyone remembers, Next Computers.
Wasn't that Steve Jobs?
Yeah, back before they sold. Yeah, I worked at NASA for a summer and Apple for Claris for a summer. And
okay,
this is going way back when.
I didn't realize you had that engineering degree, and I'm interviewing another author, Roger Dooley, author of Friction, this week, and he chemical engineering background. I interviewed your former colleague, I think it probably is Teens Woe.
Yeah.
Electrical engineering, about his excellent book, Subscribed. And there are so many engineers in marketing. Maybe there's something going on there. So,
yeah.
Aaron, how best can listeners learn more about you and your book?
Easiest is go to predictablerevenue.com, predictablerevenue.com. So there's about me. I do speaking. We have a predictablerevenue.com as a specialist in outbound prospecting, helping companies be successful there. And there'll be links to the From Impossible to Inevitable book, which of course is on Amazon as well.
Okay. Well, super. So I'm going to include links to your site, the Jason site, your LinkedIn profiles, your Twitter handles, all the books that you've mentioned on this episode's show notes, all at marketingbookpodcast.com. And I'll include a link to the book website. But there's also something else I'm going to include, because I'm an excitable book nerd. As I was reading your book, I thought of at least, I think it's up to 9 or 10 other books that if you liked this book, if you people read this book, and let's say you are in the startup world or the hyper growth world, there are 9 other books, I may add a few others, that have been on the podcast that are excellent follow-up reading to this. And I know you know several of these folks, and in fact, even one of them, The Sales Acceleration Formula by Mark Roberge, you talked about
that's a great one.
His book, and there were other folks, but there's about 10 books that I'm going to include on there, because the other reason I'm doing this is because every day, on almost every day, LinkedIn, I'm getting messages from listeners from around the world, and they're asking me for specific things, or they'll say, hey, I just went to a startup, or we're going to go start this, or whatever, and I'm able to I'm able to make book prescriptions, because I don't think they need to read 235 books to get started. There might be one, or in this case, there's these 10. So we're going to include that, and I hope that the listeners will also reach out to you to thank you for being a guest on the podcast. Obviously, you don't have much time during the day, and there's lots of podcasts that would like to interview you. So for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on whatever your favorite podcast app is, all these links can be found by going to this particular episode with Aaron and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is From Impossible to Inevitable, How SaaS and Other Hypergrowth Companies Create Predictable Revenue. The authors are Aaron Ross and Jason Lemkin. Aaron, thank you very much for joining us again on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Hey, Douglas, hey, thanks so much. Really a pleasure to be here.
And that closes the book on episode 236 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist. To support the Marketing Book Podcast and start your free Blinkist trial or get 20% off your yearly plan, visit Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast or just click on the link at marketingbookpodcast.com. And please join us next time as we welcome Roger Dooley to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his new book, Friction, the untapped force that can be your most powerful advantage. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Amanda Harrison.
Hey, this is Aaron Ross, co-author of From Impossible to Inevitable, How SaaS and Other Hypergrowth Companies Create Predictable Revenue. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
You know what I'm just reminded of, Aaron, is when you did that the first time I interviewed you, you said that, and then you went, bum, 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 bum.
Oh, yeah, did I?
You did. Sure, it was very funny.
And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. Dun, 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 dun.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.